Good Monday morning, everyone. We're sitting over here in rain, not even thunderstorms, just straight up heavy, hard rain. And it's cold outside for us Texans. It's like 40 degrees. So we're all freezing and raining up over here. But you guys listening to Author Talk with me, Amy Russell, Valerie, and our lovely author guest today is Marie Powell. So you guys, let's dive into the weekend, shall we? Russell is not going to like what I have to say, but we'll just roll with it. I went and checked on the status of my house because I can drive to it.
Good, and so you could find everything wrong with it.
I mean, no. So it's been fun because I've been talking to the girls about building, the process of building, what it looks like, all of those things. So they've been learning as we go. But they're putting on the like plywood or whatever goes on the side of it, the sheeting, whatever that is, with the weatherproofing. But I'm sure with the rain, we're going to be delayed some days. But it's cool to kind of see this whole thing come
about. They're really moving along, aren't they, Amy?
I know. It's so exciting. I have videos and stuff, so I'll send them to you guys so you guys can see. But it's going to be exciting. Josh came back in town, so he didn't drive back in the snow blizzard this year like he did when Icemageddon happened. So at least he didn't have to do that. But other than that, it was pretty calm. No one in my family is sick yet. Okay, we're not sick. We're holding strong, which is a fabulous, fabulous thing. But other than that, it was pretty mellow and calm for my weekend. So what all did you guys do this week? I'm going to live vicariously through all of you guys. So who wants to go first?
I think Valerie got tattoos looking at her hands.
No. I had a fight with the printer. Oh. Not this weekend. But yes, I did.
It's okay.
But anyway. No, this weekend was football and family. The kids came in from San Antonio, so we had a full house. They brought all their dogs over, so we had 5 dogs running around watching football. And then after the game, which we were a little sad, but that's okay, we went ahead and went to my godson's birthday at a Korean restaurant for Korean barbecue. So we drowned our sorrows in soju and barbecue and big ramen, and so it's all good.
See, that's one living in Atlanta now. That is one of the things I miss the most is the international food of Houston. Houston has the best international food in all of America. People don't realize that there's 160 languages spoken in Houston. It's vastly diverse. I've traveled all over the world. There's only 2 things I've never been able to find in Houston that was as good as wherever I was. So I got to tell you, I'm very jealous.
It was great. Yeah, my mom came in from Centerville for my godson's birthday, and she had never had any of this stuff and just was like, oh, my gosh, we had dumplings. We had fried dumplings. We had soup dumplings. We had all the noodles, all the ramen.
Did you make her eat kimchi?
All the Korean barbecue, all you can eat. I think she tasted it, but she was tasting a lot of new things because they have the platter of all the sauces and all the little, you know, the potatoes, the kimchi, cucumbers, all of that. She was tasting everything. So I was like, don't like that. Kind of like that. I was like, okay, next time you come in, we'll try something else. And so that's good. We're getting her out and just making her try new things. It was good. And the kids were, and they were even teaching her how to use chopsticks.
Wow.
So my mom, who's 79, was using chopsticks for the first time.
I love it.
It was good.
I love it. I can't use chopsticks to save my life. I try. I do like little hair tie around it. So I put 4.
You know, the last time.
You're like, put the one like here and then go over there.
When I was in Japan, I was at a little, the place where I had food that moved. Oh. You remember that video?
Yes.
That little old man next to me was making fun of me about the way I was using the chopsticks.
See, I would be made fun of. Like, this is another reason why about traveling, right? We were talking about traveling earlier. This is another reason. Like, it's just, I try, you guys. I put forth an effort. It doesn't.
Just do it. If you can't do it, then you say you tried.
I do have a question to Marie about her weekend, because I noticed in her book, she was talking about her castle hopping all the time.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know, did you do any castle hopping in Saskatchewan, Canada this week?
You know, we do have a castle here. I have yet to visit it. But, yeah, there is a castle here in Regina. It fellow has made a mansion, basically made a mansion for his wife, I guess, years and years ago. And this other younger guy took it over and has renovated it into a proper medieval castle. So I'm going to connect with them and go and see that. But yeah, no, we don't really have, you know, in 150, well, it would be, it's like nothing here really that it's, would be building wise would be older than, you know, 150 years. So yeah, not too many medieval castles here anyway.
Oh, Marie, that sounds incredible. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
We interviewed an Irish writer one time who lived on a farm that was older than the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, which reminds me of what you said, because there's nothing in Saskatchewan or most of the United States that's more than 150 years old that's built.
That's built, yeah. Like there's petroglyphs and things like that, right?
Right.
Obviously settlements and things like that. But in terms of actual buildings or castles or anything like that, yeah, it would be a bit of a stretch. There was a Scandinavian guy who tried to build a ship here. So there is a shipbuilding museum just outside of Regina. You have to, in context, we're in the middle of Canada, right? And it's like, it used to be a glacial lake. So it's like pretty flat, you know, there really isn't a path to the sea from here. So what this guy thought he was going to do with his ship is beyond me. But, you know, anyway, he built a ship because he went a little nuts and, you know, lived literally in the hill. And so there's a museum just outside of Regina to him, the Suchanan Shipbuilder Museum.
What did you do this weekend?
Outside of Moose Jaw, I guess it is. What did I do this weekend? I was very serious this weekend. I did work, you know, like I have a, I'm a mentor for a younger fantasy writer, and she and I met for the first time and had a, like in person, you know, she drove all the way here from Saskatoon. And we had coffee, about 250 miles.
So three-hour drive.
About that. Yeah, she drove here. Mm-hmm. She drove home again.
Wow.
But yeah, we had coffee. So, yeah.
So do you think it was worth our first meeting? Are you going to do
video
in the future?
Well, yeah, we're going to do a combination of Zoom and you know, we're going to try and meet in person, though. She likes to meet in person, and I think that's, you know, it's such a rare thing to do. Why not? Right.
Well, I'm a big believer in the eyeball, you know,
yeah,
going eyeball to eyeball.
There is something about, you know, just sitting there and you get to know a little bit, I don't know, more easier. It's quicker.
You can read a person's nonverbal communication.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. A little more relaxing or whatever.
Marie, do you get to mentor authors very often or writers?
This is my second time. And I work with a bunch of writers who are like immigrants and refugees, newcomers to Canada. Twice now I have edited a little anthology for the Saskatchewan Writers Guild and Regina Open Door Society, which is our settlement society here. And that was, you know, that's working with sort of mentoring, you know, I'm editing their work, but I give 4 workshops and we work on trying to generate material in English because, you know, they're probably pretty proficient in their first languages. Otherwise they wouldn't be taking that route, you know, to try and write something, but their job is to write in English. So it's like, it's interesting to do that. And twice I've mentored, this is my second time mentoring a fantasy writer as she's attempts to write.
Are these adults or?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Adults or? Uh-huh. Gotcha. Yeah. Yes.
Before we
That's
get
very to... rewarding, I'm sure.
It's really, I mean, it's surprising how much you learn, you know, by trying to help somebody else through their process. It's like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, it was good, actually. This writer, the nice thing about mentoring somebody is you get to have a little back and forth. So you're asking them, like, what are you reading? You know, like, and so you get to read some new books and find some new authors that you probably wouldn't have found if you didn't, you know. So, yeah, I like it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Awesome.
Before we get to your book, I wanted to thank the people listening to us on our podcast. We're rated top 10 independent book podcast in America. We're very grateful about it. Most people don't watch us on Monday mornings when we're live, but they listen to us during the week, driving to work, working out, whatever. And we want to thank them for it. Amy has changed the page on our podcast a couple of times, so it's a lot easier to find us. Amy, where can they find us?
It is a lot easier. Like we say all the time, you guys, Russell can find us, so therefore you can find us. It's pretty simple.
If I can do it, anybody can.
It's pretty simple for sure. But you guys, if you want to watch us and engage in the conversation, you can go on over to our Facebook, YouTube, any one of my social media channels, along with Russell and Valerie's. I tag all of them in it to engage with us. I am very animated. Me and Valerie, we talk a lot with our hands and we control what comes out of our mouth, but not always our facial expressions. So it is always fun to just kind of come on exactly. over and watch us. If you want to listen to us, you can find us anywhere in which you can listen to a podcast, Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, Google Play. I'm sure there's others that I'm not mentioning. Those are just the popular ones off of the top of my head. But all you do is you type in Author Talk, look for the crimson, red, or maroon, crimson, red, burgundy, and gold lettering Author Talk. That is us. All of our episodes that we have done over the past 8 years are up there. Also on our YouTube channel as well, if you want to go and see how we started and how we've evolved into what we are today and what we will continue to be and evolve even more as time kind of goes on. But Russell, I have a comment for you. I'm surprised you haven't mentioned anything about my backdrop because you always are the first one to give me hell about it. So I'm going to go ahead and just jump in there. No, my office is still not picture ready. It still is not. It's become the center part of my packing experience.
Oh, because you're loading for your new house.
I am. All the stuff that we're not using that we're not going to need till the summer, we're loading up. And so it's in my garage and my office. So it's just a crazy old time. Well,
I actually can't criticize you for this because I totally agree with your investment plan, as you know.
Yeah.
Marie, they are actually building another house, and instead of selling this house, they have it ready to go, and they're going to rent it. So they're going to be able to, they have good financing on it, so they're going to be able to make money on it. It's just, they're being really smart for people as young as they are. So my only criticism is they're building a house as opposed to buying a house. It's built, and Amy has a good answer for that. So I can't actually criticize you for any of this, Amy. You're actually being really smart about this.
Then it is a good Monday, you guys. Oh, my gosh. I'm knocking on wood that it continues. It is a good Monday, then, if I can get praise from Russell over here. But, Valerie, let's carry on that. That's...
I'm sorry, y'all were freezing for a minute. Either I'm freezing or y'all are freezing. Or you said you're ready to go? Are we ready to roll?
But let's get Marie talking about her books and castle hopping.
All right. Oh, sure. Yes, well, you know,
I have more castle hopping comments, by the way.
Okay. All right.
Tell us about it. You want to talk about it real quick?
No, okay. He's going to interrupt.
No, not yet. Okay, gotcha.
All right. Well, I write fantasy.
Of course.
You know, this is my book. Anyway, I write it's medieval fantasy. So it's set in 1282 to 1284 Wales, right? And it's called Last of the Gifted. Spirit Sight is book one, Water Sight is book two. And they basically are telling the tale of two siblings who pledge their magical gifts to save their people from Edward I Longshanks and his ruthless army as they invade Wales. And they get a little help from the last true Prince of Wales after his murder. So it's got a little bit of, you know, speculative fiction, ghost. It's a little bit of a ghost story, I guess you could say. And this is, I think this, I can say this is my heart project. There's the two books there. And if you can see them, I love them. I'm showing them to you because I think the covers are gorgeous. They were done by a young guy in England named Callum Jagger, who I think did a really good job for me on the covers. And yeah, basically I got the idea from castle hopping. That's how it all came to me.
Oh, that is so cool. How long have you been castle hopping?
2006 was the first time I went to Wales. My grandfather's Welsh, so, and he was a Welsh speaker, but it was sort of the thing that he said to my father, that my father said to me, was never go to Wales. It's been ruined, you know, slag heaps took over the mountains and everything is awful there because of the Industrial Revolution, blah, blah, blah. And that's why he came here to Canada. And anyway, I just couldn't stand it any longer. I had to go and take a look for myself. And actually, it's gorgeous. They have done an amazing job of cleaning up whatever happened in the Industrial Revolution, because it's an absolutely beautiful country. Not as touristy as Ireland or Scotland. And so I took my kids, and I had this sense of, you know, Welsh castles. We were going to go see Conwy and Beaumaris and, you know, Carnarvon, the big ones. And as we were there, I discovered that they're not Welsh castles. They're English castles that were created to subjugate the Welsh. Well, you know, I knew that. It just hadn't really entered the brain. And we at that time were renting a house for a week on a Welsh sheep farm near Dolwythelyn Castle, which is a Welsh prince's castle of the Welsh princes. So we decided we'd go there. Very different. Where we had been to the big castles, you know, we had to have tickets, and there was things going on. There were people to take your tickets. Number one, there were guides to, you know, you could pay a little extra to get a guided tour of the castle area, because they're huge. They're like little towns almost on their own. And, you know, gift shops, things like that. Well, Dolwythelyn Castle, there was nobody there but us. We drove in. We were the only car in the parking lot. We were the only people there. We went up the hill to this beautiful, austere, you know, kind of in silhouette, it's very black on the top of the hill. Up the hill, beautiful waterfall, gorgeous countryside. And here was this ruin of this castle. And the door of the castle is actually on the first floor. It's not on the lower, it's not at the ground level. So you don't go in at the ground level. You have to climb up this sort of rickety set of stairs. And of course, there's all these great signs around with people, you know, little pictures of people falling off cliffs and stuff like that. It's kind of like enter at your own risk, right? So anyway, we wander into this castle, and there are placards all over. It's kind of like a guided tour, but you have to read it. You don't get to put the little earphones on because there's nobody to give you that, right? So anyway, we were walking around reading that, and I was learning my Welsh history at the same time, and just was really struck by it, the loss that the Welsh people had in 1282 to 1284, just in those 2 years. Basically, their entire way of life flipped, right? Very rural, sort of pastoral way of life. And all of a sudden, they're invaded by, and this is a little country, kind of fits in my province. We'd fit it into the little Cypress Hills area. It's really quite small. and, you know, I could imagine, like, just standing on the wall walk of this castle, looking out over the mountain and imagining 10,000 troops coming at you, who are, you know, heavily armed, well-disciplined, the invading force of Longshanks, Edward I. And anyway, they won, obviously, and basically took over the country. And then the Welsh lost their they lost their land, obviously, but they also lost their law, because they had a whole system of law that was replaced by English with English law. Their ability to use their own language, because they weren't allowed to trade. They weren't allowed to stay in their own little villages anymore. They were all taken over by the Welsh, or by the English, pardon me. And the Welsh were not allowed to stay in after 5 p.m., et cetera, et cetera. It was an interesting history, given here we have a very similar history with the First Nations that I knew about. Even here in Regina, there's an area of Regina, the exhibition grounds, where if you were First Nations, you would have had to stay there in the early part of the 1900s and that. You would have had to stay there if you wanted to stay in the city overnight, and obviously not allowed to speak the language anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So all those things kind of started at this invasion. And the more I found out about it, the more I wanted to find out about it. And that just kind of, you know, led me to read, and the reading led me to write. And yeah, this is the result.
And so I know you're the author of, like it said, I think over 40 books. Is that right? Or 40
children's books? Yeah, children's books. Yeah.
Yes. And so is this your first young adult novel?
Yes. Yeah. They both of them are kind of like a series together. These are the ones I did before. This is my very first book from 2000, was published in 2006.
Dragonflies are amazing.
And they really are. And it's a scholastic book, right? So, I mean, this is how I entered into the field of, look at that gorgeous. This is okay. Yes. So this book, this is scholastic. I mean, that's the top of the top in children's books, right? But the I was working on this. This is a nonfiction book, and they bought it from me, and we're working on it. And the editor said to me, "Can you do like we're going to do like a fact box? You know how they do those fact boxes so the kids can find information right quickly." So she said, "Do me some facts. You know, just send me a bunch of facts, right?" And so I did, because I mean, hey, I can do that. So I sent her about 20 different facts about dragonflies. And instead of doing a fact box, she got right into it. And this is the result. See this sort of graphic? Where is it? There, how that goes like that. That's a fact. So instead of putting them in a box, she put them in a dragonfly, essentially, like iconic dragonflies.
So awesome.
Isn't it? It's just incredible. Well, they did things I would never have imagined.
Incredible.
Look at that one.
What is incredible is that your transition from these beautiful books to now you have these two novels of a series. It's medieval fantasy for young adults. Just, I guess, you know, the thought process that goes into the story planning and making these characters likable for young adults. And it's an award winner. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the character development and the fantasy aspect of it, please.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's not much of a stretch. Like, I'm a journalist by nature, right? I was trained as a journalist, and I worked as a journalist for years as a reporter, photographer, you know, for newspapers, and then went into magazine writing.
Me too.
And then into children's nonfiction writing, right? Which wasn't much of a stretch at all. And then, the way that I got into this is instead of, you know, people, when I first started working on this, my fascination was the history, right? The Welsh history and the stuff I didn't know and how much I was finding out and doing all the research, because that's kind of your nonfiction aspect, right? And everybody kept saying, well, why don't you just, you know, set it in outer space or something, like set it in some fictional world, just invent the thing. And then you don't have to worry about what the Welsh did. Like, who cares? You know what I mean? Right? I'd go blah, 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 blah about the Welsh, you know, and the 1200s and the this and that. And like people's eyes would like glaze over, and, you know, like they'd be like, why are you worried about this?
It's obviously your passion.
Well,
that passion into your story is very evident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of part of the thrill for me, was to make that transition over and to do that. Because some of my characters are historical and some of my characters are totally invented. And then I have my grandfather aspect, right? Because I never met my grandfather. He was dead before, all of my grandparents were dead before I was born. So I was always a little bit fixated on them, maybe, you know, like a little bit obsessed maybe about, you know, who they were and what they did and all that. And my grandfather sort of is an unknown quantity. Nobody really knew exactly where he came from. We knew he was from Wales. He spoke Welsh, but nobody seemed to have ever recorded much about him, you know, so nobody knew. And as a result, it was all kind of open in for me to, you know, fill in the gaps, right? Yay! Gaps! I love gaps. So anyway, there were a lot of gaps in the Welsh history at that time, because a lot of records were deliberately destroyed. Whole buildings, like Edward actually took whole buildings in around Aber and what is now Conwy in Wales. And like one abbey, took it apart, stone by stone by stone, walked it 7 miles down the road and built it again as a different abbey, because he wanted control of that. He changed names of stuff, like names of towns, names of, you know, waterways, rivers, things like that. He changed the names so that they would be English instead of Welsh. He just, like, his proclamation that he sent out said, "I have terminated the Welsh." You know, it's like, whoa, right? Meant a little different in that time, but nevertheless, pretty strong language and pretty strong sort of taking, literally subjugating, like literally putting somebody under your thumb.
Marie, right? Do you get that in the book? Do you put that kind of thing in the book?
I do as much as I can, you know, because I want there to be a little bit of, at the same time as this is going on, there is a lot of back and forth between the English and the Welsh in the marches, right? Lots of intermarriages, lots of stuff going on. And obviously the Welsh survived, you know, in some manner. So they must have had a few allies who just never admitted they were allies, right? So I want there to be a little bit of that going on as well, a little bit of who are your allies and who are your enemies, essentially, you know, and how that all works out. So yeah, I wanted to play with the intricacies of history, the historical, how we actually get through life, right? Because that is part of history, but also bringing out some of, because that antagonism is still kind of there. Last year, I went and did a little bit of research in Wales for the third book that I'm working on now. I can hear myself. Anyway, I did a little bit of research in a town called Nevin in North Wales, where they speak Welsh. It's like you walk down the street, you can hear it. You know, it's like really cool because this is a language that you weren't allowed to speak up until they, 20 or 30 years ago when they kind of got their ability back again to, they're not an independent country from England the way that, you know, Ireland and Scotland are, but they nevertheless have their rights to their own language again. So if you want to work in Wales right now, you have to speak Welsh. If you have a government job, your second language is going to be Welsh. And so you have to take a class and do all that kind of stuff. The schools are being taught in Welsh. The signs are in Welsh again, you know, and so on, right? So they're renaming things back again. So it's quite a cool time to kind of be involved. But there is a field in Nevin that they call Edward's Field. They say it in Welsh, and I'm not going to even try, but the translates to Edward's Field. It's kind of like this overgrown place that everybody knows where it is, and nobody touches it, right? Nobody's been in there for, you know, this decade anyway, right? It's like all of that antagonism is still there 800 years later, so.
So, Marie, I love how your characters have not so magical powers, but fantastical powers. Can you tell us, because it says spirit of the water, spirit of, so the animals and the water. And then how does this story, what is their goal in the story to achieve with their special powers?
Their goal is to survive and to help everybody else that they're with, their crew, if you will, or their people survive. Yes. So but their magical powers are very traditional Welsh powers from the, you know, stories that my family told, which are basically Hugh is able to kind of mentally bond with animals, like see through their eyes, if you will. And that evolves over the period of the two books. Transforms into a different type of power. I don't know if I want to get into it too much. It's almost like a spoiler alert at that. And
don't.
Okay. And his sister, Catherine, has the ability to see the future even in a drop of water. So she's a water seer. And that evolves into kind of a traditional Welsh thing about being able to lay the dead, if you will, like being able to help the spirits, you know, transfer.
So you're incorporating. Yeah. So you're incorporating Welsh, I guess, mythology or just traditional tales into your medieval fantasy and then building the story from there for their survival. Is that correct?
That's right. And it's the magical powers that help them survive, right? That if they didn't have them, they wouldn't have been able to avoid the English in the way that they did. Yeah.
It's my metaphorical way of saying.
Yeah. Basically Welsh legends and stories are how the Welsh have kept their traditions and kept their language in over an 800
year gap. That is so amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty amazing.
Both of these are available. Sure. Yes. And I saw you have an audiobook of these. That's incredible, because then, you know, we can be out and about and be listening to it as well. And so which one should we read first?
Spirit Sight's the first one. I think they are better read in order, but I'm hoping that people can pick up Water Sight if they're more interested in the Spirit Sight is told from the boy's point of view, Hugh's point of view, and Waterside is told from the sister's point of view, from Catherine's point of view more.
That's
but they're both in there. They're both in there, but the driving force of each book is either one of them, right?
Marie, do you flip back and forth between point of views?
Yeah.
Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
Like chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, chapter four?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you only use those two point of views in the book?
For the first two, yeah. This third one I'm working on, I've got a third point of view in because one of the muggle characters, one of the non-magical characters is going to have her say in this one. So this one goes a little bit more into, and this one goes a little bit more into survival after the war as well. Because that's what got me as I was writing the first two. I think the arc of the first two, it's kind of like a duology. You know what I mean? That story kind of, I'm pretty happy with the way that story moves and resolves. But there's a lot left unresolved because they somehow survived this war and somehow managed to find a way to continue into the future. And all of that is missing. There is like this real gap of history between 1284 and about 13 something in Wales, you know, where basically nobody knows how they survived, right? Or exactly what was done to them or what they had to contend with. There was definitely two uprisings during that period of time that were squashed. So they obviously were still out there kicking, you know, the Welsh, sort of traditional Welsh. So I want to kind of work with that, you know, the Welsh resistance, if you will. Because, you know, again, anything that's a gap you can walk into and make something out of, right? You know, it's just too tempting, right? And also because there are some characters that simply disappear and in the real history of things. And I want to just see what I can make of that. You know, if these characters disappeared out of history, it doesn't mean that they were dead, right? Obviously, they could have been still, they could have survived it and been doing things behind the scenes. So I'm working with that idea in the third book. Yeah, but still, I still want the magic in there because I'm a fantasy writer and that's what we do, right? It's all about the magic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm Valerie, if I may, I'm a little bit impressed that you are integrating Welsh culture and literature and tradition into your fantasy book. I think it's a nice preservation too.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, that's what got me, right? Was that, and what I was hearing when we first went over there back in 2006 is that the Welsh language itself was pretty much like languages evolve over time. I teach English as a second language too. So, you know, it's a little bit my thing, right? But language evolves over time. And like with trading with other people, you get new words, you get things happening. And the Welsh language, because it was literally being, you know, spoken, kept underground in the mountains is kind of how we understood it in my family, you know, as that basically they kept to themselves a little bit more than the other Gaelic people. And because they were so close to England and had to deal with that whole, you know, subjugation factor. So I went to Nantgwrddwyr, which is in Northern Wales, and I took a Welsh class. And attempted to speak Welsh, which I can't do. But my teacher at the end of our class said, okay, now you guys are kindergarten Welsh speakers. You know, it's kind of that's what I am, right? I can say cheers in Welsh. It's iachida. But not much else. Anyway, I wanted to make sure I use some of the language in my books. I wanted to make sure I use some of that culture because I was impressed that after 800 years, back it came, you know, like it's on the signs, it's in the school. If you send your kids to school in Wales, they're going to be learning in Welsh. It's like Welsh first, you know. If you, like I said, if you want a job there, you're going to have to learn to speak Welsh. That's why they have places like Nantgwrddwyr available, you know, like, and you're expected to take the class, you know, and learn to speak it. And it is slowly coming back. Like, I think it was something like 17% of the population spoke Welsh back in the 1990s, and now something like 20 some percent of it. So it's a very slowly coming back in, but there are whole villages like the one I went to where people, young people are speaking to each other in Welsh as they run by you on the street, you know, which tells me that Welsh language is definitely the language that they're preferring to speak. So that kind of tells me.
And so in your books, there are like Welsh words. And then, so like Russell was saying, just the history aspect, the tradition, are your stories maybe a little bit maybe a little connection of the Welsh mythology or legend, like you were saying? Can you expand on that, please?
Yeah, sure. You mentioned the audiobooks, and we were very careful to pick Welsh narrators. So I actually have narrators from Wales who are narrating the audiobooks, because I thought that was, you know, that important to me, right? But I wanted to deal with, okay, there was a story that I had heard in my head that I wanted to use in this book. Sorry, I didn't hear it in my head. I heard it and kept it in my head, whatever. Basically, if you think of yourself in the 1200s, you know, you're at a feast or whatever with the king, and you're a bard, and you're supposed to tell a good story. Everybody there, all the other bards, are telling good stories, and it's your job to tell a better story, because that's what they do, one-upmanship. And there really isn't a prize to it, but, you know, you want to be the one who everybody is talking about. So this particular bard goes out into the forest, you know, he's looking around, and he's trying to figure out a story that would be good to tell. And what he sees is a rabbit or whatever. And the rabbit, you know, as he's watching the rabbit hops along and it turns into a deer, you know, and the deer walks along the forest a little ways and turns into a hawk, and the hawk flies away. And so it goes. And so one animal becomes another animal quite fluidly. And in the story that I heard, I'm sure there was reasons why the different animals were chosen. But what I kept of that was that fluid transition from one animal to another. There is two kind of ways that authors use transformation in books, and some of the authors that you'll read who have that aspect to their books will make it really hard, you know, and it's difficult for that person to change into another shape. There should be some difficulty to it, right? But I wanted to deal with the aspect of the animals themselves being able to shift quite fluidly. So that's what I wanted to use in my character when he moves from one. It's difficult for him to come back to human after he's transformed, but it's not difficult for him to move from one animal shape to another, or one bird shape to an animal shape, and so on. So I wanted to kind of play with those traditions, those stories that I had heard. And that's, I think, to me, the difference between Welsh magic and the magic that you hear about a lot more, which is Irish or Scottish magic, where, and not so much Scottish, but the Irish magic, where things seem to be like, there's good magic and there's bad magic. There's no good and bad magic in Welsh. It's all wild. It's wild magic. That's, you're dealing with, you know, like wild hunts and things like that. It's dark stuff. If you're going to deal with magic, you're going to be dealing with the dark, right? And I wanted to kind of work with that, you know, so that it's a little bit dangerous.
Can you define the wild magic? Define the wild magic, just to clarify, because like you said, it's dark, or is it just...
To define wild magic would be like an oxymoron or something. It can't be done, right? Because wild magic is the magic of the earth. You can't control that, right? That's what gets you in the end, right? You know, like,
unexpected for sure.
Unexpected, but also it's nature, right? Like you think you can control stuff, but you can't. You know, human beings, we don't control nothing, right? In the end, what's going to take us down is what's happening to us right now, right? The earth is taking back her own, right? Like, you know, all the things that are happening, all the weird weather, that's wild magic, right? That's kind of what it is, you know, it's what,
and then your characters are embracing it.
Yeah, my characters, that's the magic that they're involved in. So they're not so much in control of the magic as they are the benefactors of the magic when it chooses to use them in the way that it's going
utilizing to utilizing it, utilizing their connection.
Yeah.
Yes, gotcha.
Yeah. So I wanted to really work
That's
with
incredible.
That.
That's incredible. I love it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so I have a question.
I teach elementary school, and I love that transition.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love it. Well, now, Marie, I have a question before we run out of time, and I don't usually chime in, but I'm curious to know, are you a part of, like, because it's historical fiction, right? So are you a part of, like, the Historical Fiction Society so then you can kind of bounce ideas off of other authors
Absolutely.
That write? Okay, and similar ones? Because if not, I was going to be like, that would be perfect for you because I'm not, everyone listening or watching, they all know, like, I'm not the writer on this podcast. I just market and help your guys' envisionments come to true or to life, I guess, is a better way of saying it. But I always like to, you know, put myself in those shoes, and I could see, like, being an author, having, like, those kinds of connections to bounce ideas and be like, hey, does this make sense, you know, or a writer in a similar time period and those kinds of things. So
sure. I mean, the Historical Novel Society, I'm a member of that. And that's one of the things I did when I went to Britain. One of the times I went was literally for the Historical Novel Society of Britain's conference, you know, because you can always pick up things from other people who write, whether they're writing in your time period or other time periods, you know, there's always some interesting stuff going on. And just that energy, you know, like other people who have their pet years, pet time periods, you know what I mean? Yeah, absolutely. And also, I just believe in associations. You know, it's such a, like, writing is kind of a lonely thing to do. It's like you're sitting there, and like I say, literally sometimes people's eyes just glaze over, and you know, like, you got to work hard to make this to make this matter to them the way it matters to you, you know.
Right.
But when you're in a group of other writers, it's like everybody's kind of, oh yeah, that's your thing, huh? You know? So it's like way easier.
Absolutely.
Way easier for sure. But yeah, and also, like, when I mentioned at the beginning being a mentor and all of that kind of stuff, that's through my associations here, the Saskatchewan Writers Guild mainly. And I've mentored through the Writers Union of Canada. So I'm big on associations, you know, like, I just think there's a real value to sticking together, finding out stuff and helping each other out. As you, that's like, what you're talking about, trying to make some kind of headway in a marketplace that is so huge and big, you know, and if you don't have a big publisher yourself, then I think, you know, it's good to be in an association that can help you get some visibility, right?
And, oh, yeah. And to be surrounded by, like, like-minded, you know, or not like-minded, but write in a similar genre or time period to kind of bounce ideas off of and stuff, because I'm a firm believer just in marketing, you know, like, you can be too close and then it's like, whoa, what? Right. So that's why I was just curious, because I was just like, it sounded like you were a part of one, you have a good, you know, community and everything that can help you. But I just wanted to kind of know, because some authors, you know, it's those kind of communities, especially being indie or small press published, it's important to have other author relationships and community relationships to help push you further out, because you're really doing everything yourself, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that's why I was like, oh, I'm curious. Sometimes I'm a nosy Nancy and I wanted to know. So I was like,
fun. It's definitely fun. I'm going to Devon this year. The Historical Novel Society of Britain is having its conference this year in Devon. Actually, I missed the one for the States last year, which was, I think, in Texas, San Antonio.
I was there. So I know that the one
I really wanted
this
to go to that
there.
One. Yeah, I wanted to go, but fun. I ended up doing it online just because of the cost of, you know, getting to different places. But yeah, I mean, that's a really good group too, the Historical Novel Society of America, like the American group. Our Canadian group is connected to the American group, and they're very slick. Man, they are organized. I really enjoy that, you know. It's nice to know people who can do things that they need to do quickly and efficiently, right? You know, it's great.
I know. I was amazed, because I was the sponsor in Texas. And so I was thoroughly amazed. And it was like my first time. And I met so many amazing, talented authors that wrote in time periods that, you know, I what didn't even know about, or like
I know
they like kind of warped that. It was amazing. Oh, I loved it. It was such a good time. So I'm excited you're a part of that and you have such fabulous backing. But I do know that we are running out of time, which is why I wanted to ask that before we ran out of time. So let's go to last minute questions, comments, statements. Russell, you unmuted, so you go first.
I could not ask you about castle hopping because your description of finding the whale's castle was so beautiful.
Wow.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed that. I hope some of the description ability that you showed in that answer is part of the book. I'm sure it's a beautiful book. Where can people find your books?
Everywhere. Amazon, mm-hmm. obviously, you know, all the online sellers and in some of the bookstores here. But also, if you're looking for links and things like that, you can find them on my website. And if you remember Marie Powell from Canada, mariepowell.ca is who you're looking for, because there are thousands of Marie Powells out there. It's like a Jane Smith type name. You know what I mean? In the Welsh terms, it's a pretty common one. But mariepowell.ca is my website. So there's links there. The books are there. All my kids' books are there. All my young adult books are there. And there's a whole series of links you can just click on. So
wonderful. Mm-hmm. Valerie, your turn.
Marie, I really enjoyed meeting you and hearing the whole story and how you built that story up. It sounds intriguing. Best of luck to you. Congratulations on your awards.
Thank you. Thanks, Valerie.
Awesome. Well, Marie, thank you for taking time out of your morning to come and hang out and just have a conversation with us about your books and your passion behind writing. It's always so refreshing. So thanks so much for taking time out of your morning hanging out with us.
Anytime. Call me up.
Absolutely. You are welcome back anytime. Well, those of you listening and watching, we hope you all have a fantastic Monday, a great rest of your week here in Texas. Stay dry, everybody. But until then, bye for now, everybody.